You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Well, good morning, everyone. I think we'll go ahead and start right on time. We're all invigorated by the Redskins' win and this beautiful fall weather, so we'll get right at it. Thank you for coming today. I'm Mike O'Hanlon, and I'm joined by two of my colleagues from the Brookings Foreign Policy Program, Cliff Gaddy and Steve Pfeiffer. And we're here to talk about Russia. And as you may have noted from the write-up to our event, we're actually beginning the discussion with an attempt to think more about what's inherent to essentially the Russian national security psyche or character. In other words, we're trying not to immediately rivet our attention on President Putin. Inevitably, we'll come back to him. Inevitably, we'll come back to current events. And I'm sure that many of your questions, which we'll field in the second half of the event today, we'll probably focus on current events. But the event grew out of a project that Cliff and I undertook, which was trying to get at the question of what would Russia's long-term national security paradigms or choices be, and to some extent, how could American policy perhaps influence and affect the way Russia would make its choice. And so it was trying to, in a way, divine the inner Russian mind beyond or apart from Putin. It's pretty hard to do at this juncture, given the degree to which the old KGB operative has come to dominate the Russian national security and political space. And I think many of you know that Cliff Gaddy is the co-author of an excellent book with Fiona Hill on that subject. So I'm doing a little bit of introduction here by show and tell. And I think many of you have already seen this book, Mr. Putin, new and expanded edition, which came out after we were well into the Crimea-Ukraine crisis. So it's Mr. Putin, operative in the Kremlin. This is one of Cliff's many books here in a career stretching about a quarter century at Brookings. He's also a paramount economist, understanding Russia's economy, and one of the best books he ever wrote, in my judgment, was called The Price of the Past, which helped understand the legacy of the Soviet militaristic economy for post-Soviet Russia. And he's written many other great books over the years as well, and an article called Russia's Virtual Economy, which was extremely influential in understanding this period, too. Steve Pfeiffer was a career Foreign Service officer working largely on issues of Russia and Ukraine before he came to Brookings about a half a dozen years ago. In the same spirit of show and tell, one of his Brookings writings is called The Opportunity, and this was about next steps in U.S.-Russia arms control. I had the opportunity to help out a little with that book, but it was really his brainchild in many ways, in most ways, and also it was Steve reflecting his previous work in the arms control space, where a lot of his Foreign Service career had been spent, but he also was U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. And so as the likelihood of U.S.-Russian arms control has declined in recent years, he's focused a lot of his attention on the crises of Central Europe and also is now working on his next book, which will be, in fact, on Ukraine itself. Let me just say a brief word, and in the spirit of show and tell, I'm also going to plug shamelessly my latest book, which is called The Future of Land Warfare, and which has a Russia-Baltic state scenario. Not that I am predicting that we'll have to fight such a thing, but like many of you, I'm more worried about it than I might have been a couple of years ago, and more worried that we have to at least think about shoring up deterrence for that and other potential problems with Russia. But today's event will focus, as I say, at least as its starting point, on this notion of what's inherent to the Russian national security psyche, or to what extent can we define several different possible paradigms and explain them, try to root them in Russian history, Russian politics, and then, again, try to discern which way the Russian state may be headed and, to the degree we have influence on that, how we might exercise that influence. So the way we'll proceed this morning, I'm almost done with this long introduction, don't worry, and then I'm going to hand the floor to my co-author on the article that I was referring to, Cliff Gaddy. We wrote this article in Washington Quarterly, and it came out of this notion of trying to think 10 years down the road when we hope Mr. Putin will finally be taking his leave from the political stage if it hasn't already happened by then. As you're aware, he could, in theory, stay another decade in power, and there's every possibility that he might try. But also there is the separate question of to what extent the Russian population is really inherently with him, to what extent the Russian population and political system could go in a different direction. So before turning over to Cliff, who's then going to explain a couple of the conceptual frameworks that he and I developed, and then Steve to comment on those and give his own take on where Russia might be headed, Let me just quickly list for you the five main philosophies, paradigms, concepts that we think Russia may consider as it defines its longer-term national security policy, getting at the issue of what really drives Russian foreign policy and national security thinking. We developed a total of eight concepts, but I'm not going to list all of the eight. There were three that we thought pretty unlikely. And in fact, even of the five that we're going to put before you today, the first one's going to sound very unlikely. Remember, we're trying to think beyond Putin. So please stay with us on a little bit of the potential for getting beyond the rut we're in at the moment. But the first one we define as a pro-Western Russia. This is not a Russia that's all warm and fuzzy in its dealings with us or knocking on the NATO door trying to join or anything like that necessarily. But going back a little bit to the feel that we sometimes had in the Yeltsin years, for example. And then there's a notion we call a minimalist Russia. And this is a Russia that sort of decides to mind its own business in the national security realm and focus primarily on economic development. Obviously, Russia, with its huge landmass, huge natural resources, northerly climate, which may actually become more conducive to agriculture as the planet warms, and many other things about its basic character, basic economic character, it could, in theory, decide to emphasize economic development, which, of course, would be desirable in many ways. And so we describe this Russia as a minimalist Russia, not as interested in throwing its weight around the national security realm. The third concept, and perhaps the centerpiece of the article, and I'm sure one Cliff will talk about a little as he develops a couple of these frameworks in more detail, we call a Reaganoff Russia. And here we're trying to evoke, of course, the notion of Ronald Reagan. But let me be a little more specific before Cliff gets into the concept in more detail. What we mean by this is a Russia that is patriotic, that sees its defense industry as helping spur broader economic growth, and that ideally doesn't use its military a lot. If you think of the legacy of Ronald Reagan in the United States, from our point of view, he won the Cold War without firing a shot, and he actually didn't use force much around the rest of the world either. And so to the extent that a Russia could be proud, patriotic, somewhat pro-military, and yet restrained in its use of military power, this may or may not be the worst possible world we could imagine. In any event, we define this as a Reaganoff Russia, and that's our third paradigm. The last two are a little more negative. One is the besieged Russia that's angry at the world and looking to lash out. And the final one is a greater Russia that's trying to exercise as much influence as possible, especially in areas where Russian speakers live around the world. These last two concepts may evoke more of the way Putin is behaving these days, and I think they sort of speak for themselves in that regard. So thank you for being here today. As I say, we'll turn now to Cliff and then Steve, and then we'll get into the discussion with you as well, including, of course, attention to current events as you see fit. But again, thank you for being here, and now over to my good friend, Cliff Gaddy.
Thanks a lot, Mike. Well, first of all, thank all of you for coming. It's good to see such a big group and good to see a lot of people that I haven't seen in a while, so old friends. It's always a pleasure to see you. I want to thank Steve also for taking his time. He's, like Mike said, he's an expert on everything these days that's in the news, and so it's valuable for us that he can actually spare this hour and a half or so to be with us, so we appreciate that. I especially want to thank Mike. Now, Mike said that this article and this project that we did towards a Reaganoff Russia was our joint work. Mike is modest as usual, and he followed, I guess, the Economist tradition of always listing authors in alphabetical order. So I'm actually listed as the primary author. But for me, Mike was the much of the brains behind it. This was so refreshing. Mike said, I've been here for a long time. He's been here for a long time at Brookings, too. And we have in the past actually done a few things together, but it's been a long time. So working with Mike on this was very refreshing, specifically because, you know, I think Mike is sometimes described as an expert on pretty much every issue in foreign policy, but he's not really an expert on Russia. And that turned out to be, for me, incredibly refreshing. Here's Mike O'Hanlon, an expert on defense and security issues, including most notably on budgets and on actual capacity of militaries, looking at the problem of a country, Russia, that he knows a lot about, not maybe everything, but he's able to step back from this narrow kind of blinder view that a so-called Russia expert like myself may have and just ask some fundamental questions about this country, its history, its culture. As he said, even its geography, its security challenges, but also its constraints. The same way you would look at the military budget and the capabilities and the possibilities of the United States or other NATO countries. And that's exactly, I think, what characterizes what we've done and what I hope comes across to those of you who take the time to read this very short article. I mean, it's very brief and telegraphic almost, is the notion of just always keep in mind realities, that there is a reality constraint, no matter what's happening in Russia today and what we may think President Putin is up to. There is a reality constraint there, and there will be in the future, and it is perhaps most important of all that we keep those in mind. Now, Mike said we started off with 8 scenarios. We have kind of like a playoff system, and we eliminate 3, and we're down to 5, and then we work through those, and we're down to 2, sort of like finalists here. And that was the one he mentioned, the Reaganoff option. By the way, brilliant, provocative term. You have to read the paper to really understand exactly what we mean. Of course, it's not implying that they're going to behave like the United States under Ronald Reagan, except in this dimension that we mention, that we talk about, of creating a very expensive, very large military force with lots of shiny new weapons, and you boast about them, and you parade them around, and you occasionally throw them out there in the world a little bit. But that's not really what it's about. It's not building up a military for the purpose of, you know, expanding your power, your empire, and your domain. It has a strong domestic dimension. In the United States, it was about reviving pride in the country and patriotism and so forth. And this is what we would mean in the Russian context. So you sort of adjust everything for what you might think about a Russia, and that's what we say might be one of the potential outcomes. The other one is not that different. The other one we ended up as what we said would kind of be likely is a somewhat more aggressive Russia. We call it besieged Russia. Both of these are kind of in the middle of the spectrum. I think they're 5 and 6 on the scale of, you know, starting with the absolutely utopian post-Westphalian Russia that's just the nicest guys in the world, don't want to hurt anybody. It's like Austria or Switzerland or somebody, all the way to one that would revive the Soviet Union, quite literally. We call it a Brezhnevian Russia. So that's 1 to 8. And so we're talking about that somehow it is most likely that the Russia of the future down the road, 15 to 20 years, is going to end up somewhere in the middle there. Well, that's a sensible, easy, you know, cop-out if you think. But it's also because the forces of realism, economic reality and political reality, we think are going to compel a kind of a consensus with ups and downs, with some volatility, to move in that direction. The Reaganoff Russia, I guess, I mean, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. As I say, this paper itself is telegraphic, so it still would be more difficult for me to go into a lot more detail. So it's in there. What I actually would like to talk about is not the other, quote, finalist that we came to, the one that's the more aggressive variant of the Reaganoff Russia, which has a lot of stuff, a lot of weapons, but doesn't really aggressively necessarily use them frequently. But one that was not there at the end, and this is the minimalist Russia. Remember Mike said this minimalist Russia would be driven more with considerations for the economic realities of a country like Russia. Realize that there are limits to what you can spend, on the military, because you're damaging your economic strength. And if you think perhaps that economic strength is the name of the game, that's where the competition will be in the global arena, you concentrate on that. You could also justify that emphasis on backing off a bit from the global activism, concentrating your own economy, because you simply point out the reality that your military strength depends on the strength of your economy. And if your economy is not strong, then you're just not going to be able to realize these. So could be a mixture of the two. And the reason I want to concentrate on this minimalist option a little bit is because I think that maybe it's unknown or maybe it's not familiar to you that there is actually a debate in Russia, pretty vigorous debate really, as usual, kind of below the scenes, behind the scenes, among the elites, of course, that's really all that counts there, in which this minimalist Russia is actually quite strong. Now, its strength among certain elites doesn't necessarily translate into political likelihood. I don't think the pure minimalist variant, the a variant in which Russia concentrated, was satisfied with having its nuclear forces, above all, providing the adequate security and protection that it needs, and that it would back off from global politics and maneuvering in the geopolitical sphere, concentrate on obviously reforming, developing its economy. This is a group in Russia that's led by the technocrats, the liberal economists, some of whom were the most active people, of course, during the 1990s, and by business elites. They recognize, interestingly enough, this is not a utopian vision, in the sense of they do not ignore the political realities. If we think about the Reaganoff version as being more perhaps attuned to political realities, the culture of the Russian mind, the desire for patriotism, nationalism, national pride, also, by the way, attuned to political domestic realities in Russia, because you build up a big military, because you produce a lot of stuff, and a lot of stuff being produced means those factories out in the Urals and elsewhere are cranking out whatever, tanks and everything else, providing jobs for people, maintaining, therefore, the social peace and the political peace inside of Russia. I've always argued that that's probably the more important reason for having this whole big defense industry program that Russia has. It's about keeping the jobs out there in the heartland. But the minimalist Russia, concentrating more on the economic constraints, is also attuned to this political reality. These guys are patriots, and they always stress that. They call themselves enlightened patriots. And they do not question the need for Russia to defend itself. They do not even question the fact that Russia is threatened by the outside world. Their argument tends to be that it is counterproductive for us to overextend ourselves in military spending and in foreign adventures, and we have to concentrate above all on getting our own house in order, getting our own economy in order. It is tempering, if you like, that group, whether or not they actually, and I don't think will, fully implement their vision of what Russia's security future should be like. I think they always will be tempering the more extreme versions, including those that we rejected as being too kind of aggressive and expansionist, as well as perhaps even some of the ones that we considered might be more likely. What we have here, in brief, and I think this is important to realize, is the notion, as I began, realism asserting itself, and particularly asserting itself in Russian history. This is a pattern in Russian history. More than 100 years ago, after Russia's fiasco in the Russo-Japanese War, 1905, the prime minister at the time, Sergei Vite, a person who Putin has referred to as kind of one of his heroes, Vite, the prime minister, wrote a letter to the commander-in-chief of the Russian army, General Kuropatkin, and he told him, you know, I think, Vite says, it would be smart if Russia would go ahead and learn from the lesson from this war, acknowledge that it's actually a second-rate power. It should stop trying to pretend like it is a first-rate power and vie for a global leadership position, and instead should concentrate on getting its own house in order. He wrote literally, quote, "We need to begin a new active phase of our national life, a phase of sensible construction. We need about 20 to 25 years in which we should concentrate on our own affairs and back off from international relations," end quote. Pretty interesting quote. Now, of course, it obviously didn't happen. Other things intervened in those 20 to 25 years. But Vite was neither the first nor the last of very prominent Russian figures to adopt that sort of sober realism that, again, had an influence on policy, even if it never completely dominated, or if so, only for brief periods. Go back 100 years before Vite, there were advisors close to the czars, the advisor to Nicholas I, Count von Benkendorf. These were realists who thought, you know, if we don't get our own system in order, we're not going to be able to play a role globally. And above all, they stressed this breathing space notion, the idea that we just need some period. Some people said, Stalin said 10 years. Stalin was also at one point thinking this as well. Others 20 to 25 years in which we need calm and we can concentrate on our own affairs. Another prime minister after Vitis Stolypin said the famous quote, give the state 20 years of calm at home and abroad, and you won't recognize Russia. This is the notion of a kind of a strategic retreat, a regrouping, a rebuilding. It is not abandoning the ultimate aspiration of Russia's role as a great civilization and great force, but is acknowledging the reality that if you push too hard, too fast, too aggressively, overspend, you're going to undermine your own position. And this is part of this minimalist creed that I'm thinking is important. And my final point is that don't dismiss even changes in Vladimir Putin. He may well remain in power, as Mike said, until 2024, the end of a possible second term as president. But remember that he came into office in 2000 with kind of a variant of this minimalist creed, at least that Vitte Stolypin idea of the breathing space, and he expressed it in his document that's called the Millennium Manifesto. And he has always, then and now, had people with influence on him, at least people to whom he listens, who espouse this view. And today, as I said, it's a rather strong group in terms of intellect and in terms of influence, or at least voice to Putin. It is anchored in those technocrats and liberal economists. We could name some names, Alexei Kudrin, Putin's longtime associate and former finance minister who still has Putin's ear, people like Igor Yurgens and others who are concentrating on this. And a few days ago, just to make the concrete point, they issued a report in which they literally said, and I quote, it may be a good thing that we got booted from the G8 after the Crimea thing because it then forces us to recognize we're not, as they say, in the Premier League of international politics. We've been relegated back to, essentially, they mean where Russia belongs at the present time, in the lower division, like in global soccer terms, right? So it's a wake-up call. We don't belong there. And they even quoted this Vitte quote that I gave to you earlier. So, and by the way, they're using, of all people, Dmitry Medvedev again, guy who nobody even remembers anymore, even inside of Russia, it seems. Medvedev made a big manifesto himself a couple of weeks ago in the papers, and it attracted a lot of mocking comments in the social media. But he kind of said the same thing that these guys are saying. And I think we have to only assume there, not that Medvedev is a serious actor, but that Putin must have sanctioned what he wrote. That being my point, that these thoughts, scenarios, they're kind of alive and well in Russia, and we should always keep them in mind. All options, in a way, are open, and that's why I hope that this little paper that we wrote can be a handy outline as people begin to think forward. I mean, obviously track current events, but think forward 5, 10, 15 years in which our planning on our side, which maybe we can talk about how we would respond to this militarily in our own military planning, would take this into account. So we have a little scorecard, a little outline, and it's like at a ball game. You got to fill in the scorecard. We don't fill it in for you. The game is not over. But we have what we think is a handy way to think about these issues.
Cliff, thank you. And before going to Steve, I am, however, going to ask you to fill in the scorecard very briefly for the three options that I think you focused on most, the minimalist Russia, the Reaganoff Russia, and the besieged Russia. And if you, I'll just ask one question, one brief question. If you had to rate the odds of each of those being the most influential paradigm in a decade in Russia, based on not only what you're seeing Putin do, not only what you're seeing the United States do by way of reaction, but what you see going on within Russia itself. Yeah. Do you have a ranking in terms of likelihood, or is it just really way too soon even to be able to bet?
I think it's too soon, but I think I think implicit in what I was saying is the story is the interaction of these three, maybe you could say, because it's minimalist Russia, right? And we also put this in financial terms or in budgetary terms. We talked about, we had another sort of dimension of the thing between a muscular Russia, a big spending, muscular Russia that would spend $100 to $150 billion a year, putting it clearly in a second tier, not the U.S. Nobody competes with the U.S. We spend more than everybody put together, but way ahead of all the European powers. That's a muscular Russia. The minimalist, and we say the Reaganoff version as well as some of the others would fit into that paradigm in terms of outcome. We saw the minimalist Russia being a much smaller, maybe as little as $50 billion a year, arguing that a minimalist Russia, the kind of defense that would be needed for a minimalist Russia, would focus obviously on nuclear. Russia would retain its parity, essentially, with the United States in nuclear. And special forces. You know, this is the new game in Russia that I don't think they're going to back off from, which is you don't need this mass mobilization, million-man army that was pretty worthless anyway, but you can take whatever the number is. I don't even know if anybody knows the number of their real special forces these days, a 2,000, 3,000, a handful, relative handful of incredibly well-prepared and equipped soldiers, and get a lot done. The interesting thing, I think, is that showing how these things bleed into each other is that, you know, we say in the paper that maybe Putin today is more the besieged, you know, because there's more aggressiveness there than this Reaganov option would take. But you could say, well, it depends on what you think Putin's intentions are with both Ukraine and Syria now. I think it can be interpreted in both cases that these are more demonstration. They're kind of bluffs. They're kind of trying to puff yourself up like a peacock to get some recognition and a place at the table, the respect that you obviously didn't get in the 1990s and not gotten until now. So we're going to act tough and act, not just talk, but act, but not with the intention of expanding an empire or whatever some of the other versions of Putin's intentions may be. And in a way, it fits almost into a Reaganov version if it doesn't go further. I mean, again, this is the Russian version of a Reaganov version. Reagan, we invade Grenada or something, right? But, you know, Putin, he's going to do it in a more aggressive, he's Russian, he's going to do it in a more aggressive way. But still, quite different than the idea of trying to reconquer the Soviet Union. So, what is still in Putin's, and I think those around him, whether or not, you know, they succeed him or not, but the entourage around Putin, they are very, very much concerned about Russia's economic strength and role in the global economy. They don't have the illusion that Russia can cut itself off from the world economy, so they couldn't possibly go for some of these more, you know, hardline variants unless, you know, events push them to that. So I would suggest looking at the way these things, the realities, again, the economic reality being foremost in the minimalist version, the political realities being kind of in the Reaganov or the besieged Russia, these three that are in the middle, and they're kind of tempering each other, so you won't ever get a pure minimalist version. But I don't think you really will easily get a pure politically driven, throw all economic constraints to the wind, kind of approach, and not likely. So it's still going to be somewhere there in the middle, and I guess that's why we kind of landed on the Reaganov / besieged as being in the middle, but it could, you know, pull in one or the other direction.
Well, thank you. And Steve, over to you now. Thank you for playing this game with us with our spectrum of specific constructs, but also feel free, in addition to commenting on any of those you wish, to lay out your own view of how you think about Russia's future.
Sure. Well, thank you, Mike. First of all, let me commend the article. I think it does a really good job of laying out that spectrum of security paradigms that you can see for Russia looking out over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And I think it's also important to look beyond Vladimir Putin. If he adheres to the Russian Constitution, which he did in 2008, he stepped down and became prime minister, he will be out of the presidency in 2024 at the latest. And so then you get into the question, who comes after? And that's a hard game to play, although I think in terms of looking at these various models for Russian security future, it's probably at least as likely as the person who comes in after Putin is going to look a lot more like Putin than he'll look like a Gorbachev 2.0. I mean, that's sort of the way I look at it, certainly in the next 5 to 6 years. And I think Mike and Cliff have done a good job in sort of ruling out the less likely paradigms and focusing just on three. And I'll just talk briefly about those three and then offer some comments on some implications and some constraints. First of all, I hope, Cliff, I think you're right. There is this debate going on about this minimalist line. And I think you used the phrase sober realism. I hope you're right on that, because I think from the point of view of American security interests, that's the best Russia to deal with. But it does seem to me that that requires a real change in thinking at the top in terms of basically Mr. Putin in the next several years concluding that Russia's future is not going to be based so much on its place on the international stage militarily or geopolitically, but on focusing on economics at home and deciding that he's going to really make some changes to build in Russia a competitive free market economy. And I'm not sure how likely that is. The second paradigm, the Reaganoff, may well be then of the two remaining ones, the ones that is most in the American interest, certainly better than the besieged Russia. But if you look at where Russia is now, I think it's best described, as you did in the article, as a besieged Russia. And it's a Russia that's driven, I think, by a mixture of both foreign and security policy goals, but also heavy domestic policy influence. In the last several years, the play-up that Mr. Putin's made to Russian nationalism, but also this theme of Russia's back, we're on the world stage, you know, we matter. And I think that has a big domestic aspect. But it's also an approach that seems to me driven by a large sense of grievance. If you look at the way that Putin and others in the Kremlin talk, it's just driven with grievance against the West. NATO enlarged with the objective of hemming in Russia. The Orange Revolution, the Tulip Revolution, the Rose Revolution, the Maidan Revolution, Arab Spring, these were not manifestations of local populations unhappy with bad government or stolen elections. These were all planned, instigated, organized by the CIA and Western European security services, again, targeted at Russia. And you even go back to some, and they're saying, you know, the Soviet Union's collapse, again, that was somehow engineered in the West. I think that narrative has huge holes in it. There's not a good basis. But when you look at what Mr. Putin says, he says it so much, he appears to believe this. And certainly that is the narrative that they're selling to the Russian people in what is, I think, accepted as probably a far more intense propaganda campaign domestically than you've seen even then in Soviet times. So that's the kind of Russian I think we have to deal with now. In the article, they sort of outlined two alternatives for Russia, a muscular Russia that tries to have not only nuclear forces at the base, but full spectrum, so special operations forces, but also conventional forces. And I think that's the kind of Russia that Mr. Putin and the Kremlin now aspire to. I mean, it's not just nuclear forces and special operations forces. They're talking about revitalizing the Russian fleet, you know, the Russian Navy going out in the Mediterranean, going out into the world's oceans in a way that it hasn't done for the last 20 years. Now, I think that's the aspirational goal. The big question is whether they are able to achieve that. And if they can't, then they fall back to the model I think you described as the porcupine Russia, which is very heavily dependent on nuclear forces, perhaps some special forces, but doesn't have the full spectrum of capabilities. And that'll largely be determined, I think, by economics. Now, that kind of Russia, either aspirational as a muscular Russia or a porcupine Russia, I think is going to require some more attention from the United States. We're going to have to think about Russia, and we should be thinking about Russia now in geopolitical terms and in military terms in a different way than was, say, the case 3 to 4 years ago, because we've seen Russia now asserting itself and using military force in a way that 3 or 4 years ago most did not think the Russians would do. Now, having said that, I think also it's important to recognize that whether Russia aspires to muscular but has to settle to porcupine, whatever, there are some very significant constraints on what Russia can do. And I'll just go through some of them. First of all, can Russia sustain the accelerated level of defense spending that we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years? At a time when the Russian economy is suffering because of the low price of oil, Western economic sanctions are having some impact, and the Russians passed up some opportunities in the last 5 or 6 years to reform the economy that might have made it perform in a better way. Second, can the Russian defense industrial base deliver in terms of what Russia wants? And this is a base which I think has been widely seen as probably one of the more corrupt sectors of the Russian economy. There's a question, you know, can they deliver high-tech goods, particularly when they're now sanctioned, in terms of what the West is doing is blocking the flow of high-tech to the Russian defense industry. And in some cases, there's some huge holes. There was an interesting article last week that said Russia is considering now selling 3 brand new frigates that are under construction because they have no engines, because the engines were gas turbine engines built in Ukraine. And Ukraine has now said, we're not going to provide those engines. So you know, that there are holes and there are some dependencies that actually Russia has on Ukraine that the defense industrial base in Russia may have a hard time filling. I think there's a question, can Russia match the West in high technology? Where you have some analysts saying it's not the issue of can Russia close the gap when you get into things like long-range conventional strike, but can Russia increase that gap from growing? And I'll just raise a couple of examples. The Russians, about 3 years ago, with great fanfare, unveiled the new T-50 fighter. This is their so-called fifth-generation fighter. It's the equivalent of the F-22. Now, the F-22 has been deployed for more than 10 years now. But there, again, you had a deputy minister of defense a few months ago saying that they're going to reduce the buy of the T-50 to 12 aircraft in the next 5 or 6 years. That does not suggest that that high-tech fifth-generation fighter is working in a way that the Russians want or that they can afford. One other example of where I think limitations on high-tech, and you know, I think Mike's been following this pretty closely, if you look at Russian air actions in Syria over the last 5 or 6 days, it seems that they're dropping lots of dumb bombs, not very many precision-guided weapons, whereas I think in the U.S. case now, virtually everything that the American Air Force drops, and sometimes they hit the wrong target, but it's precision-guided weapons. So I think there's some limitations in terms of the Russians' ability to integrate high-tech into their forces. Another limitation is demographics. In 2017, the number of Russian males who turn age for military service will be half of what it was in 2006. That's a limitation if you want a big army. You have an army in Russia that is still largely dependent, or about 50% of the enlisted personnel in the army are conscripts. These are people who get 1 year training, then they're out. And my guess is that most Western militaries would consider the level of performance that somebody with just 1 year in the army can achieve, particularly if you're aspiring towards a modern high-tech military, is pretty limited. And then I think the other constraint that we can see, and we may be seeing it as we speak, is do the Russians make mistakes that, in fact, get them into difficult situations? It may turn out that the Russian military action, the support for separatism in the Donbass and eastern Ukraine was a mistake. And I think we may well be seeing the Russians now inserting themselves into potentially a bigger mistake in Syria, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Now, these constraints don't mean we don't have to worry about Russia, but I think, you know, in terms of the adjustments we make to our own security thinking and our own military policy, we can be smart. So looking at two or three main areas, strategic nuclear forces. As the article makes clear, that's going to be the foundation for Russian security. And if they have to cut back defense spending, they're going to, I think, devote still money to building or modernizing their strategic nuclear forces. I don't think we have to worry a lot about that, because a lot of what the Russians are doing now is replacing old missiles and old bombers that they would and should have replaced 5, 7, 10 years ago, but in the 1990s, they simply had no money to do it. So in the current modernization program that's supposed to go out to 2021, Russia's going to buy 400 intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarine-launched ballistic missiles. That sounds like a large number, except that's basically the number they need to replace the missiles, the SS-18s, the SS-19s, the SS-25s, the older submarine-launched ballistic missiles that are going to come out of the force in the same time. So I don't worry that much about the strategic nuclear force modernization as long as two conditions apply. One is we continue to observe the limitations in the new Strategic Arms Reductions Treaty, which both sides continue to do. And second, the United States goes forward with the steps to modernize its own strategic forces, which are now being planned out and we'll begin to see take effect in 2020s. A second consideration, non-strategic nuclear forces, that's an area I tend to worry about a little bit because it gets into some Russian doctrinal questions. And it's also the issue of Russia's violation of the Treaty on Intermediate Range Nuclear Missiles. But I don't think that requires that the United States should get into now a buildup in non-strategic nuclear weapons, simply because we have a different approach. We look at those weapons. There's no advantage in a competition in non-strategic weapons for the United States, in large part because our doctrine says those weapons have a relatively small role. It's mainly political. It's a signaling purpose. And the signal is that we're on the verge of going to something that neither you nor we want, which is escalation at the strategic level. On conventional forces, I think there are some things that the United States should be doing now and we should be thinking more seriously about in Europe compared to 3 years ago, and that is looking to maintain conventional hedges, particularly in the qualitative hedge. So things like precision-guided munitions, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, those sorts of assets which have been strengths that are multipliers for the U.S. military, we want to maintain. And I would argue that in the sense of sort of deterring and assuring, deterring Russia, but also assuring allies in Central Europe and in the Baltic states, it probably would be smart to, build up somewhat the American and NATO military presence there. I'm not talking about anything large. Currently, the United States has persistent rotational deployments of units of about 150 troops each in the three Baltic states and Poland. If NATO could take that up to 300 to 600, again, light infantry, I think that would be useful in terms of deterring Russia, also in terms of assuring those states. But if it was light infantry, it would not be a huge offensive threat to the Russians. So, again, I think looking at whatever paradigm the Russians end up choosing, it's well within the capacity of the United States and NATO, particularly when you're looking at countries that marshal economies that are, 15 times the size of Russia's. The West ought to be up to the challenge. Let me just, after having said that, I think Russia is now in the besieged paradigm. What does that mean for the current crisis of the day, which is implications for Syria? I think some cooperation is possible, but I think it's going to be limited. So this channel which has now been set up between the U.S. military and the Russian military to deconflict ongoing air operations in Syria makes a lot of sense. When you have those military forces operating in close proximity, you want to have some conversations so there's no miscalculation. And the point was highlighted over the weekend when a Russian military aircraft flew into Turkish airspace and was escorted out by F-16s of the Turkish Air Force. So you want to make sure you avoid mistakes like that. I tend to be skeptical about broader cooperation because it seems to me that there are a couple of big obstacles. One is Washington and Moscow do not agree on what happens to Mr. Assad in any kind of transition. And that's a huge political obstacle between Russia on the one side, which supports Assad, and the United States, other European countries, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf, who all believe, rightfully in my view, that any transition has to include the departure of Assad from power. That's a big obstacle. I think a second obstacle that's become clear in the last 5 or 6 days is we may not be fighting the same things in Syria. U.S. military action has been directed at the Islamic State and ISIS. Now, the Russians have said different things. On Wednesday, when the Federal Council was asked to rubber stamp Russia's use in force, my guess is that this vote actually took place after the Russian Air Force in Syria has already received its marching orders. But Sergei Ivanov, the head of the presidential administration, said, our goal will be exclusively the Islamic State. The next day they said, well, Islamic State and extremists. Extremists is a really broad word when used in Russia. If you take part in a peaceful demonstration in Moscow and hold out a Ukrainian flag, you can be charged with extremism. On Thursday in New York, Foreign Minister Lavrov made a very interesting comment. He said that if it looks like a terrorist, if it acts like a terrorist, if it walks like a terrorist, if it fights like a terrorist, it's a terrorist and presumably subject to Russian military action. Based on what we've seen in the last 6 days, the Russians are not dropping many bombs on ISIS. All right, the Islamic State. They're basically conducting military activities designed to support Assad's regime and targeting a lot of groups, including groups that we would consider relatively moderate opposition groups. And so I guess I would amend what Mr. Lavrov said. I think what Russian policy, as we've seen in the last 6 days, is if it looks like a terrorist, acts like a terrorist, walks like a terrorist, fights like a terrorist, or if we, Russia, choose to bomb it, it's a terrorist by definition. And I think that's going to be a problem because, again, we're going after different things. There's very different objectives now in Syria which are going to make cooperation complicated. Finally, just I think one last thing that a specific implication of what the Russians have done is it seems to me that there's been an option talked about from time to time over the last couple of years, should the United States and the West impose a no-fly zone over Syria. I think that option has now become very, very difficult, if not impossibly difficult. If you're going to do a no-fly zone, you have to be prepared to shoot down offending aircraft. And shooting down the Syrian Air Force is one thing. Shooting down Russian airplanes is going to be something very, very different. So my guess is that option's now off the table.
And thank you very much, Steve. And we can come back to Syria in just a moment or anything else you wish in the discussion period. I've got one question for Steve, though, before we do that, and then we'll go straight to all of you. And before my one question to him, let me just add one more clarifying comment on how we've developed some of these options. You heard Cliff refer to the possibility of Russia spending maybe $150 billion a year on its military rather than $50 billion, those being sort of two relatively extreme choices along a spectrum that we would consider plausible. Steve talked about a porcupine Russia or a muscular Russia. So just to map these things, because I know we're throwing a number of terms at you which may or may not be useful to your understanding of the situation. Steve's kindly going along with what Cliff and I have in our article. But the porcupine Russia, the nuclear first, special forces first Russia, of course, that corresponds more to this $50 billion a year entity in terms of Russia's military, where Russia essentially spends about as much as the larger European nations each spend on their militaries. The $150 billion a year Russian military budget, by contrast, is, of course, the muscular Russia. And that's the one that puts Russia clearly into the number three spot, the clear bronze medal spot internationally in terms of its overall military budget. And, of course, either way, it's going to stay tied for the gold medal. At least that's going to be the aspiration in terms of nuclear forces. But the $150 billion a year muscular Russia, they would be presumably still less than China's budget, but much more than any other country. And so this would allow Russia to continue to sort of tell itself and tell the world the story of being the great Eurasian land power. So anyway, I just wanted to tie some of those pieces together as we develop them in the article. But Steve, my question for you, going back to besieged Russia, as you know, in the article, and other people have made similar kinds of arguments, there actually are two even more dangerous Russias on our spectrum. And one of them is the greater Russia, where Putin or a future leader could aspire to actually control most of the areas in the world where Russian speakers live today. Of course, this could include parts of Latvia and Estonia, in theory. It could include parts of the Central Asian republics. That's obviously a pretty dangerous Russia if anybody really wants to go there. And then, of course, there's the Brezhnevian Russia, which is any former Soviet ally, in theory, should be brought back into Moscow's orbit. Do you worry?
Does that include the eastern half of Germany?
Well, that's a good point. So there's a little play in these concepts. But do you worry about either of those, and especially the greater Russia? Do you worry that Putin feels a mandate that wherever he can, opportunistically, he may try to actually either annex or at least create, you know, frozen conflicts in places like the eastern Baltics where there have been Russian speakers historically?
Yeah. Well, no, that's a really good question, Mike. I guess I'd make two comments. One is, I think it would be unwise for NATO not to think about what, in essence, is the greater Russia conflict. I mean, I worry a little bit about, could you see a little green man scenario in Latvia or Estonia? In each of those countries, the population is about 25% ethnic Russian. Now, I don't think it's high probability, but it's not zero. And I think 4 years ago, I would have said it's a zero probability. And so when I talk about doing some things to beef up NATO presence in the Baltic states, it's basically to take steps to deter that kind of scenario. Now, having said that, my second comment would be, and when I read the article, I guess at the end of the day, I probably do discount the greater Russia model. Because when you look at basically reoccupying territory, and the Kremlin has said now, going back to 2008, that Russia has this unique, I think, in international law, very questionable right, but they claim a right to be able to defend ethnic Russians or Russian speakers wherever they are and whatever their citizenship. The Daily Show about a year and a half ago said people in Brighton Beach ought to be a little bit worried by that. But the point is that taking on those territories then, though, means that the Russian economy has to subsidize them. And my guess is in Moscow they're not very enthusiastic about that. I mean, Cliff knows the economics. But it's interesting to me when you watch the Ukraine case. Within a month after Russian special forces, without insignia, called Little Green Men by the Ukrainians, seized Crimea, Russia had annexed Crimea. Now, there's a history there. 60% of the population of Crimea ethnic Russian. You know, Russia was originally colonized Crimea. Sevastopol was designed and intended to be the home port for the Russian Black Sea Fleet. In the year and a half of conflict in eastern Ukraine, you have seen no suggestion out of Moscow that they want to annex and take in that part of eastern Ukraine. And a big part of that is because they recognize, even setting aside the huge damage that's been done through the 18 months of conflict that the Russians and the Russian separatists instigated there, even before then, economically, you know, that was going to be an area requiring subsidies. So my guess is that the economic argument is a big constraint on those in Moscow who want to build a greater Russia, because they don't want to go back to the model that I think was the norm during Soviet times, where basically Russia was subsidizing all the other pieces of the Soviet empire.
Thank you. Why don't we go to you? And we look forward to your questions. Please wait for a microphone and identify yourself if you could. And if you have a question that you want to target primarily towards one person, please indicate that as well. We'll start up here in the very front row, my good friend Gary.
Thanks very much to all three of you. Fascinating discussion. As I listened to it, I was thinking it seems to me, possibly in error, that what the two of you in your paper have considered is a realm of realistic options, some more realistic than others, but it's sort of given what we know, given Putin, given Ukraine, given Syria, these five options are the ones that you've identified, the two that you focus on mostly. I wondered if in your thinking, if not for this paper, just in general, if the assignment instead had been, what does Russia need to do in order to regain a place of similar stature in a 21st century world, whether in thinking about that, you might have I've been trying to think about, you've mentioned a Reaganov model. I've been trying to think of whether the one that is in my head and I want to ask you about is whether or not Russia is capable of, under any leadership, Putin or otherwise, whether given its history and its culture, is there any likelihood that instead of taking the sort of more militaristic approach that it's taken in Ukraine and Syria, et cetera, that it could have said to itself 10 years ago, we got to get off the oil and gas, you know, one crop economy. We need to grow our economy. The future of that is clearly in the realm of technology. So we want to compete with the West in the realm of technology. I don't know whether you want to call that the Lee Kuan Yew model or the Asian Tiger model, but it is. This is a thought experiment. Would it have been possible 10 years ago? Is it possible now? Would it be possible 10 years from now for Russia to say, this is how we're going to do it, not with a larger military, not with the model that people have been seeing, but to really become a high-tech 21st century advanced manufacturing technology kind of economy?
Cliff, you want to take that? That gets right to the heart of what you've worked on your whole career with Russia's economy and its underpinnings.
Yeah. I think that's a utopian idea that Russia could move to the forefront of technology as an entire economy. There are just too many legacy problems. Not a fault of most of the current generation. It's just a fact of that many decades of a very, very distorted economy that can't be just undone by changing the economic policy. Even the best of policies can't undo the physical changes in that economic structure, the geographical changes that you have with you. You just have to deal with cities of a million people and more that really aren't all that viable as cities. I mean, you can think of what in the United States or a Western country, how we deal with regions that are underdeveloped or coal mining towns that have to shut down because the coal is gone or the demand for the coal is gone, or steel plants that supported a whole city of whatever. I grew up in a town that's 50,000 people and had a textile mill that employed 10,000 people, and it's the most depressed place you can imagine. Think if that were a million or 15, you know, a million and a half people, and think if there were a dozen or more of those kinds of places. That's just part of the problem. So, my point I've always made about Russia is that just abandon the utopian ideas, think about realism. That's why I'm really attracted by anybody in Russia that talks in those terms. And just accept the fact that, look, you got a long way to go to get even up to this second level competitive area. And that doesn't mean that that's not a goal worth aspiring for. It doesn't mean, I mean, I don't want to go into a long discussion of this, but it's recognizing that pride in a country doesn't have to be that you're the most populist or have the most nuclear weapons or most anything in that way. It can be because of your civilization and your culture, and that can, I think, be separated from the military and great power aspect of it. If you have the goals of becoming a great power, okay, fine, but then earn it. You know, work for it and see where the competition is these days. But none of that's happening in Russia right now. So when you ask, there's an economic reality to it. I just talked about the economic utopianism of such an idea of thinking that Russia can leap forward within a decade or even two or three to the forefront of economic development and technology. And there's a political aspect, and that is the vested interest, who's going to do this? I mean, the only person, I hate to say it, but provocatively, the only person who's going to reform the Russian economy is going to be Vladimir Putin. It's got to be an autocrat. Because right now, the vested interest, every populist force in Russia, of which there are lots, are absolutely retrograde when it comes to liberal economic market policies. So if you had more democracy in Russia, you would have worse economic policy even than you have now. I mean, actually, the economic policy is not all that bad. You'd have really bad economic policy. So this is the dilemma that Russia has. And so you have to scale back your expectations, it seems to me, to think about the political and economic realities, you know, no matter how you're looking at this. That's the way we did it in the paper, and that's the way we assume that even the Russian leadership has to do. And everything that Steve said about the constraints on Russia being a big, powerful military might that we need to fear, I think is irrational. Russia is tiny. Steve says, as he correctly pointed out, the Russian economy, GDP, is an order of magnitude smaller than only the United States. You add NATO onto that and you double it. Add China onto that and you triple it. So, you know, it's a fraction. It's just a few percent of its potential rivals. Okay, Japan was only one-tenth the size of the United States in World War II. They can be a problem, okay? There's a way to concentrate and be nasty. Those shouldn't be ruled out, but I think that's exactly what Steve was, and we tried to suggest in the paper. Steve said it more clearly. We need to hedge our bets against a maybe tiny but really nasty Russia that happens to have as many nuclear weapons as we do and various other forces, and yet don't go overboard. I mean, Russia is not the biggest threat that the United States faces, not even in security terms, much less in all our other dimensions.
Steve, I don't know if you want to comment on that part, but whether you do or not, I hope you'll say something about Ukraine's underlying economic potential as you see it. Maybe not in response or if you wish to Gary's question, but just as you look longer term, you were ambassador there, you know a lot of Ukrainians, obviously a part of the former Soviet Union that had a lot of economic, military, manufacturing, scientific capacity, but has turned into a much poorer country even than Russia. So I'd be curious for your thoughts.
No, I mean, I think Ukraine economically has a lot of the same problems that bedevil Russia in terms of overcoming the legacy of 70 years of communist rule. I think the difference, or hopefully the difference in Ukraine is, I do think this leadership, which has flaws, I think that they have a model for Ukraine. And it's Western oriented. It's moving more towards a market economy. The question is going to be: is can they overcome the very debilitating effects of corruption, which are still enormous in Ukraine as they are in Russia? Can they move past that? But also, I think where Ukraine has an easier challenge than Russia is Ukraine really doesn't have this aspiration to be a great power or even a regional power. I mean, what basically Ukraine would like to do is, they'd like to be left alone. They'd like to see the Russians let them have the freedom to develop relations with Europe. They do, and I think this is not just the Ukrainian elite now, but increasingly the Ukrainian populace. They aspire to be a normal European state. Model would be like Poland. They would like to be a member of the European Union. They probably understand that the European Union is going to be very reluctant on that count. The interesting change geopolitically in Ukraine over the last year is that for the first time ever, you now have a majority of Ukrainians saying they would like to be a member of NATO, which is something that's not going to happen for the foreseeable future. NATO is not prepared to put Ukraine on a membership track. But it's interesting that for the first time in 25 years, you now have polls showing 50%+ of Ukrainians say, we want to be in NATO. Being invaded by another country will do that. But aside from that, I think Ukraine does not have the aspirations that you have in the Kremlin to be a major player on the international stage. And to some extent, that's an advantage for Ukraine in terms of it rules out, you know, if you were designing a set of security paradigms for Ukraine, you could rule out the more ambitious and the more threatening ones.
Thank you. Next question, please. Let's see, where should we go? Let's take two at a time. And there are two hands, one behind the other here on the fifth and sixth row on my right. Yeah, right there. Right there and then behind also.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you very much for a very interesting discussion. My question is on something that many people in this room probably aren't thinking about because, you know, it's not the hot news of the day. But in America's own backyard, you know, over the last 10 years, we've seen Russian engagement in Latin America. And what I've been wondering is what you think Russia's strategic goals are in America's backyard and Latin America, and what you think Russia might do over the next 10 years in Latin America. Thank you.
And if you could hand the microphone to the woman right behind you, please. Identify yourself.
Hello. Eleanor Bachrach, former USAID Ukraine. You've presented three very rational, value-free models of what might happen in Russia, but it's something you've only barely alluded to, the fact that Russia is a major kleptocracy, a huge drain on resources, not going into the economy, and drive of many of those in power, it would seem, primarily to enrich themselves. So I'd like you to comment on where that fits into your picture.
Okay. Steve, you want to start this round and take either or both?
Yeah, well, I'll let Cliff do the kleptocracy issue. Other than to say that, in general, I oppose corruption, but to the extent that corruption reduces the amount of resources in the Russian defense industry to build up military power, I can live with that. On where Russia's going in Latin America, I tend to put that in the category of it's mischief-making. It's designed to tweak us. And for a long period from 1991 up until 2005, 2006, you know, the Russian Navy was not going to Cuba or Venezuela. They weren't flying airplanes there. And that was basically because they didn't have the money to go that far. In 2006, as the price of oil came up and you had greater flows of revenues in the Russian government and they began to devote more to their military, you know, they began to be able to buy the fuel, get the training. And you saw the resumption, for example, of bear flights going down into Latin America. You know, that was something that was new if you were looking back just to 1991. But if you went through the 70s and the 80s, and this happened all the time. So I would look at this as sort of mischief-making, it's tweaking, and part of it's a bit tit-for-tat, is that the Russians are very unhappy about the fact, you know, that, you know, the American Navy enters the Black Sea, visits Georgia, visits Ukraine. They see that as sort of in their, quote, backyard. I think the difference is that those countries do not want to be seen in Russia's backyard. So, again, it's designed to be an irritant. I don't think it's something that the U.S. military spends a huge amount of time. You know, I mean, they certainly watch Russian aircraft when they fly by, but they don't worry about it. It's kind of interesting when you read the Russian press now. I mean, the Russian press sees this as a big deal. You know, we now are, our aircraft fly along the east coast of the United States, and they fly around NATO countries. And it's really interesting to me that when you read these articles, they also say, you know, and we were escorted by American fighters or F-22s off of Alaska or British Typhoons when we were near the British Isles. And I just say it's kind of a weird article. I mean, broadcasting or sort of bragging about the fact that you're flying your bombers and you're being escorted. Most bomber pilots that I know on the American side think that being escorted by somebody else's fighter is a bad thing.
Cliff.
Good response by Steve on the Latin America question, because I don't think Russia has either the soft power capability or the hard power capability to represent any particular great concern to us. It's what Steve described. It's tit for tat, little mischief making. Kleptocracy, I don't think, though it's a popular term to explain that that's what Russia is. Kleptocracy, rule by thieves. I don't think that's a good explanation for for what for Russian motives, Russian behavior, the leadership. It's just, it doesn't make sense to me. And I will simply refer you to the book that Fiona Hill and I wrote about Putin. We have a very different explanation of what motivates people and what the concerns are. We do point out that, and this is perhaps part of the reason for the misunderstanding, in our opinion, corruption is extremely important in Russia. It's not kleptocracy. It is literally used as a means of control of people, especially those with economic interest of the oligarchs. It's a mafia-style thing. You get people to commit crimes, you have control over them. I won't go any further because it's all in the book.
Very good. Two more questions. We'll go here in the third row and then in the second row. And then the next round, we'll go further back.
Gentlemen, I'm Lawrence Carew from International Energy Partnership. I have two projects on hold in Ukraine. What I'd like to hear from all three of you, what do you think of RT? I was flipping through it, and there it was last night on cable. Is that Putin's mouthpiece, or is it more in the center?
Okay, and then we'll go over here to the second. Well, I've been doing it, too, so.
I have it.
Yeah. Here.
Hi, Jared Hendricks from George Washington University, a freshman. Where do you see Russia going with their like new annexation of like Crimea? Like now that they're like connected with their like the Sevastopol and stuff like that, where do you see them using that as well as like the populace with their like Russian ethnicity and their newfound patriotism to their like motherland? Like where do you see them going with that?
If you don't mind, I'll take a brief crack at the RT question and then work down the row for my colleagues who may want to add to that and then take your question as well. I've been on RT a few times. I don't know that Steve has. He may have as well. You may know that on the Ukraine issue, I have a position that is slightly more tolerable in the Russian space than Steve's, which means that RT treats me a little better, perhaps, than some Americans, but it's still some of the most challenging media experiences you could ever want to have, because there's a very strong point of view, and it's very consistent with Putin's worldview. And so you have to always ask, are you getting through? Are you being given the opportunity to express your disagreements with Russia's worldview, or is there a trampling out of that? And it's sometimes on a fine line, but I'm talking to them right now about maybe doing a show later in the week. And so I'll report back to you on whether that experience is happy or not. It's always tough. I've judged that if they let me finish my sentences, it's still worth it. But again, you're being pushed. And the other American guests who are on the show and other guests internationally usually have a view that seems consistent with Putin's worldview as well. I'll leave it at that. Do you want to start with that one, too? Because I think you've been on a couple of times.
Yeah. No, well, I not in the last 5 years.
Okay.
I have a different view on RT. I do not think that RT is a serious media outlet. It is a propaganda arm of the Kremlin.
I didn't really disagree with
that. No, we didn't agree with it. But the reason I don't, I mean, you know, Mike is a very serious, insightful, and thoughtful person. My preference would be that he not go on RT because I think he confers credibility on that channel, because most of the people that I watch when I turn on RT, and they're experts on Russia, and I go, I've never heard of that person. I think it gives your president gives them a little bit more credibility than they deserve. On the question about Crimea, the annexation there, I mean, the annexation of Crimea was usually popular in Russia. Again, Crimea was the only part of Ukraine where you had ethnic Russians in the majority, about 60% of the population. This long historical association with Russia, it was actually part of the Russian Federation in the Soviet Union until 1954 when it was transferred to Ukraine. So the way it was taken over, you know, by the little green men, or they're referred to as the very polite soldiers, is I think the way Kremlin refers to them, it was bloodless. And it was bloodless because the Ukrainians, I believe, made a decision not to oppose it. They in addition to the 10 or 12,000 Russian sailors and service people on Crimea, there were also 8 or 10,000 Ukrainian military. They stayed in garrison. They did not oppose. And so, yeah, if you fight a quick 6-day campaign, you know, you don't use a lot of military, there's no casualties, you get, you know, that's going to be popular. But I'm not sure it has wider implications. The question of Russia's involvement in eastern Ukraine, and the evidence is overwhelming. If you don't believe the United States, if you don't believe NATO, if you don't believe the Ukrainians, just go and look at social media. And you have Ukrainians, you have Russians, you have Russian soldiers posting pictures that establish the Russian military is in eastern Ukraine. I mean, there's Graham Phillips, who's a reporter who's widely seen as pro-Russian. He's, I think, quite commonly on Russia Today. He ran a story last February about the attack of the fighting around Debaltseve on the border between occupied Donbass and the rest of Ukraine. And behind him are three tanks rolling by. And those three tanks, you know, the separatists have been saying, well, we always get our heavy equipment. We capture it from the Ukrainians. Except these three tanks are clearly configured. They have reactive armor. They have gun sights that have never been in the Ukrainian military, that, in fact, have never been exported from Russia. These tanks only came from Russia. Last week, there was a picture of a rocket launch system, again, that's only in the Russian inventory. So there's absolutely compelling evidence there. And the interesting thing about the Russian, the Kremlin, is the Kremlin to this day denies that there's any Russian military presence in eastern Ukraine. And I think that shows that they very quickly, clearly understand in the Kremlin that there is no positive gain to build on Crimea by trying to go and grab additional territory or even admitting their involvement in eastern Ukraine.
Cliff, you care to comment? Any of that?
Steve covered the Crimea thing. RT, you know, I think Mike's response was a good one, is how we as scholars, members of Brookings staff, react to the media. I mean, one could do an analysis of what RT is. No question that it's propaganda arm of the Kremlin. But there's all kinds of state-run media all over the world, and we do interviews with them. I think it comes down to what you as a individual feel for not just the journalist, the individual journalist integrity, but also those who run the show. I've had situations, I mean, I don't do the interviews anymore with RT or pretty much any Russian media, especially when I know what the context is and what they really want to get out of me. I've had situations where I gave really nice interviews. They let me talk forever in the Brookings studio, and I got my point across, and it was clearly, you know, what I really thought. But then when it was broadcast, they took pieces of what I'd said and for a totally different context to support something else. Now, that, I got to say, this happens in the U.S. too. This has happened with newspapers. This has happened with broadcast media. What you do then, at least what I do, is they're on my blacklist. I have a folder in my email, you know, bad people, you know. I'm just not going to deal with them anymore. But the problem with the Russian, with a situation like RT, is that they're just so blatantly so, and you can't, it's not enough that you don't like the journalist. Some of these seem quite good people, but you just can't trust that what you're saying and doing will not be exploited. And I can see Steve's point of view about even appearing on RT now. Just even if you think they're accurately relating what you said, you know, there's a bigger context for that. But that's an individual decision. Thank God at Brookings we can make our own calls. I don't think anybody's ever told us don't do or don't appear for any media.
I'll just add one footnote. So the shows I've done have been live, which hopefully reduces the potential for monkey business, although who knows. But also part of what I've tried to do is to be clear about differences with President Putin, but also to remind the Russian viewer of why I think there should be a basis for U.S.-Russian collaboration if we can get beyond these silly problems, which I'm very emphatic. I attribute primarily to President Putin. But nonetheless, so I'll try to thank the Russians for letting us go through the Northern Distribution Network to supply the Afghanistan mission, or how we collaborated on Iran sanctions policy, to remind people that we actually have a basis and a history of cooperation. And if their president could stop inventing crises in other parts of the world, maybe we could get back to that. So whether that message is of any utility or not, I don't know, but that's part of my philosophy. So we'll go here in the sixth row, and then the gentleman over here on the outside. Yes, right there.
Exactly. Shoaib Rahim, Rumsfeld Fellow. I'm from Afghanistan, and my question relates to the recent happenings in Afghanistan, where the war is slowly shifting from the southern borders to the northern borders of closer to Central Asia. So one narrative slash conspiracy theory would be that after Russia's annexation of Crimea and the whole Ukraine situation, that the West, or more particularly NATO and the United States, was on the back foot. And so this is sort of a response where the United States and NATO allies are allowing this shift in geography. So the Taliban slash ISIL or whomever is there are able to disrupt or somewhat potentially destabilize Central Asia by being based there. And the recent 1 week fall of Kunduz was one of the indications of that. And so I'd be very interested in hearing what your thoughts on that would be. Would such a thing be plausible? Do you think it makes any sense? Or do you see a logic in that sort of narrative?
Okay, thank you. Over here.
Mohammed Mansour, I'm from Egypt. I want to ask about now Syria is airstriking. Russia is airstriking Syria. And the Egyptian, which is supposedly Egypt, is an ally to U.S., but they support Russia. And this is the official stance of Egypt now. And I saw on Al Jazeera that they are saying that it is because U.S. is, or the U.S. policy is, doesn't exist in the Middle East or retreating from the Middle East. That's why they left a gap and Russia is filling the gap. So what do you think of the Russia role in the Middle East after what they are doing in Syria? Thank you.
And I think I'll take a third question in this round too, and then we'll just see. Everybody can take their pick as to which they answer.
Hello, my name is Mark Melton. My question, when you were talking earlier about the differences between besieged Russia and Reaganov Russia, it appeared to me that in 10, 20 years from now, if from the U.S. we are observing this, we may not be able to tell the difference between the two. And my fear is that the U.S. would see a Reaganov Russia and interpret it as a besieged Russia, and then we would respond, miscalculate, and eventually force a conflict or force some type of confrontation where Russia then goes into a besieged Russia, even though they did not want to. Is there a way to avoid that? And, like, how could we, as American observers who are not well-versed, most voters are not well-versed in Russian issues, how would we be able to tell the difference between the two?
I just want to thank you for that question because it's very well couched, and also it begins to tie all the pieces of this discussion together. Because one thing we promised at the beginning, we want to ask, what are the implications for American policy of thinking of these possible Russia futures? Steve, you want to start, and then we'll just work.
Okay. All right, no. Russian motivations in Syria, there are, I think, several motivations. One is Russia wants to support Assad. They did not want to see Assad go down as a result of the conflict in Syria. Part of that is because if you're sitting there in Moscow, you don't have very many international allies, and Assad is one of them. Second, to the extent that your model is you're worried about color revolutions, orange revolutions, things like that, is this seen as another, again, Western-inspired plot to bring down a country? A third part is, and this is where I actually have some empathy for the Russians, is the Russians have asked the question for the last several years, if Assad goes, what comes after? And I think we in the West don't have a good answer for that, and that's not reassuring to Moscow. But another part of Russia's involvement in Syria, again, is trying to maintain some toehold. They may calculate that the United States is, I wouldn't say withdrawing, but trying to reduce its footprints in the Middle East, and they may see an opportunity to increase their presence, and Syria really is the only entry point that they have at this point. So I think that those motivations explain where the Russians are going. Just one brief comment on Reaganov, and I'll let the two authors then address it.
About Afghanistan?
I'm going to let Mike handle that. That's more of an Afghanistan question, I think, than a Russia question.
Yeah.
On Reaganov, I mean, this is where I tend to see besiege as a better model than Reaganov, because if you go back to 1983, when the embassy was bombed in Beirut, and then you had the horrible attack which killed 200-plus American Marines, basically President Reagan made the decision, this isn't worth it, and we pulled out, or we pulled offshore, we did some shelling, things like that, but we basically backed down. I'm not sure Vladimir Putin would do that. And I think this is the risk to Russia in Syria, is while I'm sure they're taking the necessary steps, and the ground force presence that they're deploying now, my guess is that the current numbers, it's force protection. They want to be able to secure their air bases, you know. But what happens if ISIS or another opposition group mounts an attack, succeeds, and then there are 30 or 40 Russian casualties? I don't think Putin does a Reagan and says, this isn't worth it. I think he doubles down, and I think that's the risk for Russia and Syria, is while they may go in with an intention of a very limited action, events may drive them, in part because of the way Mr. Putin looks at the world, to a much deeper, much more expensive, much more costly involvement than they originally anticipated.
Thank you. Cliff.
Okay, so Mike takes the Afghanistan question. I want to kind of link a little bit the question that Mark asked and the one about the idea that Russia is filling a gap that the United States leaves. Because the question of distinguishing, to me, between these two scenarios, rather similar, and similar enough on the surface, as Mark points out, that they could easily be confused. Reaganov, big military, mainly for show, mainly for purposes other than actually using it to achieve direct military goals of conquering territory or people or whatever. And the other one, which is literally doing exactly that with your military. So maybe same size military, same force structure, whatever, but with a different motivation and mentality behind them. And here, I think, I'm going to come back to something I said before. To me, it's even more difficult to distinguish between the two, because I think that it's at least possible to think about some of, you know, very blatantly aggressive, overt actions on the part of the Russians now or in the future that are really not designed to achieve what everybody is claiming, that they want to take over the Mideast or rival the U.S. in the Mideast, even, you know, establish a stronghold in the Mideast, or obviously challenge the United States as a, you know, new international order, U.S. leadership, which is, you know, or start a new Cold War, Marco Rubio, you know, challenge the U.S. leadership. Rather, is it possible that what is going on, including Crimea, including Syria now, are these almost bluff-like demonstrations of, we are big, we're back, you got to listen to us now. We tried to tell you you needed to listen to us. We tried to tell you all the time, you can't make the United States, you can't make these decisions about nations and their leaders and regime change and stuff without thinking about the consequences, and especially without thinking about how they might impact somebody else, namely us, Russians. So we got to send the message. You know, and for instance, in the case of Syria, here's what happens when a country goes around and does something without, you know, worrying about the other guy. Hey, how do you like it? And so now we're all obsessed with, oh my God, the Syrian, you know, the Russia's gonna screw us up in the Middle East and Syria. And it's basically that message. How do you like that? Okay? But you're not intending to commit big forces to Syria. I mean, they can't. Russia can't change. They can't save Assad if other forces are there. They can't defeat ISIL when we can. I mean, there's nothing that the Russians can do, in my opinion, that we have failed to do. Right? All they can do is make people kind of think that and get all worried about it, and that's the purpose of it. Crimea, as Steve says, nice, quick little operation, Grenada-like. You know, just do something, get all this, you know, huge support. However, you miscalculate. Eastern Ukraine, that's a different story. And what Steve said is really important. In the Reaganov option, in the Russian context, you're trying to do things that, you know, show, give people the impression you have all this power, both at home and abroad. The potential for miscalculation, and it's Marxist misperception. How are we supposed to know that, oh, that was just a, you know, that was just a demonstration. Excuse me, we didn't really mean to, you know, conquer half of Ukraine. So people are interpreting this in a way that, you know, you're being too smart about this. And that's a real risk for miscalculation on both sides. But then, Mike, maybe we should also get into the question, what can we do to avoid, is there anything we can do to avoid these sort of misperceptions?
I'll say something, but Steve has a...
Yeah, no, I just want to, I agree with a very important point that Cliff just made, which is, you know, what can the Russian military do in Syria? You know, where's the silver bullet? What capabilities do the Russians bring to the game that the U.S. military has not been able to apply. But that seems to me to suggest the whole risk of this venture is, if they can't predict success, and I think most people think they're going to fail, they're starting off on a voyage that's doomed from the start, and that's where I think it's potentially a big risk.
They're just trying to force us to act. You know, they don't intend to solve or to succeed in Syria.
Yeah.
So of course, if their intention in that scenario is they'll never even push it to that point.
Yeah.
But they can easily be trapped into a situation where it didn't work. Okay, we've got to go a little bit further, and a little bit further. And then, like you say, the Putin mentality is not to give up. Not to give up in a fight. And he said that, there's a great story in our book about him learning the lessons of life, and one of which is, if you start a fight, don't ever back down. So whether he sticks to that or not, it's kind of dangerous mentality.
Very quickly on Syria, I think there actually is a decent chance that Putin will accomplish his immediate goal of helping Assad survive. And I don't think he really has any other goals. So he'll let us defeat ISIL, or at least contain ISIL. And he'll say that's what he's doing. But I think there's a decent chance that at least, Assad's fought to a stalemate for 4.5 years. He seemed to be slipping a bit this year. He gave a speech in which he said he has a manpower shortage in his army. He lost a couple of the areas, even near the traditionally Alawite area up near the coast. I think that Russia's going to concentrate on taking back those areas and propping up his rule in the part of the country he still holds on to. And we'll see how they do. But in a sense, their goals are less ambitious than ours. So they may be able to achieve them. On this, going to the final question that was posed, very interesting question. I guess one way I would comment would be to say, I would love to have a pro-Western Russia or even a minimalist Russia. I will happily tolerate a Reaganov Russia by the way we defined it, which is a Russia mostly concerned about being a little bit, a little standoffish with the West and certainly patriotic and a little bit of more boasting and a little more occasional semi-scary rhetoric than we would like, but overall restraint in its foreign policy. I do not think Putin is a Reaganov Russia guy. Putin is a besieged Russia guy with occasional tendencies towards a greater Russia mentality. So I'm hoping to pull it back or to see the Russians pull it back. And that would be one way to just sort of, again, give some specificity to these different images we've created and link them to current events. If Reaganov Russia is something, by the way, one thing we haven't really gotten into is detail on how to think about the future of Ukraine, where we have different points of view on this podium. And so in terms of thinking, however, about how we handle the Ukraine crisis and what kind of security strategies we think about for Central Europe, again, to the extent we could steer the Russians more towards a Reaganov model, I think there's some utility in that. But I won't provoke Steve by saying what I think that might be. That's a different conversation for a different day. My very last comment, however, is on Afghanistan. And I don't think that we're trying to encourage our enemies to move northward and ultimately put pressure on the Russian flank or any other parts of the former Soviet Union. What you saw in Kunduz, by the way, despite the tragedies, and there have been a lot of them in the last week, including most recently the hospital bombing, something I've criticized, and also the tragic loss of 10 Americans in Jalalabad in the C-130 crash and the fall of Kunduz itself. Despite that, we're seeing the Afghans start to take back a good chunk of Kunduz. So don't give up yet. This is not, there's room to be at least hopeful here because this is not another Mosul. There's an immediate counterattack, and there's at least some reason to hope it's partially successful. But I think Kunduz fell in the first place because of local politics. The politics in Kunduz were a mess. And my colleague, Vonda Felbad-Brown, our colleague, is there right now in Afghanistan, and I'm sure she'll probably write about this once she's back. But she's been warning for a long time. She knows Kunduz better than I do. And this is a region where there have been a lot of militia actors competing for influence in ways that weakened the strength of the overall government and created an opportunity for the Taliban. And Kunduz, even though it's in the north, the historic Tajik region of Afghanistan, is roughly a third Pashtun, the group, as you all know, from which the Taliban tend to hail. And so there's a base there. There's a population base that if there's already trouble and mischief, it's a very clever way of using force, in a sense. We should respect the Taliban military decision-making. They did find an exposed flank. But I'm hopeful that they've bought more than they reckoned with and that the Afghan army and police are going to do a better job than they counted on. So I remain hopeful on that front. I think we have time for one final question, which we'll then use as a way to wrap up here as well. And I should go to the back if I can. So the gentleman in the blue shirt, please. Just one question, please.
I'm Basil Scarless. I'd like to go back to Mr. O'Hanlon's last comment on Ukraine and link, perhaps, if I want to ask, if the U.S. and the European Union decided to provide massive economic assistance to Ukraine, no military assistance, but in support of economic reforms, and if the EU also made clear that EU membership for Ukraine is far in the future and not something that's likely to occur soon, how would that affect Putin's Russia today? Would it make him feel more besieged?
Okay. Either of you want to start that, and then the other could finish?
I think it's an interesting question because it gets to, what are Putin's objectives in Ukraine? I think the Kremlin did not have a grand strategy towards Ukraine. A lot of this has been making it up as it goes, tactics. Crimea, in the immediate aftermath of Yanukovych's leaving Kyiv and the appointment of intergovernment, was a target of opportunity. But I don't think there's been this grand strategy that lays all this out. It seems to me that in Donbass, you do not have a Russian interest in acquiring that territory. There was a brief period for a couple months where they talked about Nova Russia, this concept of the southern 40% of Ukraine breaking away. They quickly became very disabused of that notion when they saw that there was simply no public support for it in Ukraine. What the Russians have been doing is basically using Donbass as a means to distract and destabilize the government in Kyiv and make it harder for the government in Kyiv to succeed. The question is, could you get the Russians to change that position? And in terms of the objectives that Moscow articulates, a year ago, one could have seen the basis for a win-win solution. I mean, Poroshenko was talking about some kind of devolution of power to the Donbass. He was talking about status for Russian language. He said, look, we'll take NATO off the table. He wasn't prepared to say no NATO ever, but he was prepared to take it off the table. And he said, we're prepared to have a dialogue, EU, Russia, Ukraine, and talk about how do you ensure that as Ukraine implements the association agreement with the European Union, it doesn't have a negative impact on Ukrainian-Russian economic relations. There was no interest shown by the Kremlin a year and a half ago in picking up on that. And that leads me to conclude that the Russians, again, it's destabilization of Kyiv. And I don't know that we've seen a change today. The good news out of eastern Ukraine is that since September, there actually has been a real ceasefire. And we'll see in the next coming days whether, in fact, the agreement on withdrawing heavy equipment from the line of conduct, whether that's implemented. But there's still a lot of other parts of the Minsk agreement from February that haven't been implemented. And there's reason for skepticism. One of the things that they talked about when Putin and Ukrainian President Poroshenko and Chancellor Merkel and President Hollande met in Paris on Friday was this question of local elections. The Minsk II agreement says local elections will be held in accordance with Ukrainian law. And you have the occupation authorities in Donetsk and Luhansk setting off on their own elections. Now, there was some hope. The French president said, well, we think we'll have to postpone the elections, but we think we can achieve it as per the requirement of Minsk, which is in accordance with Ukrainian law, with OSCE observers. And President Putin's spokesman went out and said, well, yeah, President Putin's going to send an envoy to Donetsk and Luhansk to talk to them about this. That's just subterfuge. If Russia wanted the elections in Donetsk and Luhansk to be held in a manner in accordance with Ukrainian law, Russia has the weight, the influence, the power with the separatists to make it happen immediately. And so my guess is that we're still seeing a Russian goal, which is destabilization of Ukraine. Maybe they're less focused on the military part in eastern Ukraine. Maybe they figure that at this point they don't need it. But I'm not sure we've seen a change in Russian objectives. And I guess my last point would be is, because of what's happened over the course of the last year and a half and the hardening of public opinion in Ukraine, which does things like now saying we want to join NATO, that may create a difficulty for President Poroshenko in that his freedom for maneuver now in terms of accepting terms that might allow a win-win solution that would allow the Russians to extricate themselves is probably less today than it was 16 or 17 months ago.
Cliff.
Oh, just quickly. I'm Steve, such an expert on Ukraine. I'm not. But on the one hand, that question is so hypothetical, I don't even know that I can begin to answer. The idea that there would be massive amounts of economic assistance from the EU and from the United States to Ukraine is so remote that I just don't know. I mean, think about it. There's no way they or we are going to do that. Okay, let's assume that it happens or it was a real possibility. I don't think that Putin would see economic assistance or economic stability of Ukraine as any particular threat. It's the military and the political threat, and the eastern Ukraine situation is what the heart of it is. But the Russians, they have plenty of levers to destabilize Ukraine economically that they haven't used. I mean, they just have a whole arsenal. But that's not really in their interest. But they will be employed if they think that's necessary to prevent a literal threat that Ukraine might join NATO or that there'd be stationing of missiles or something in Ukraine that they would regard as a threat.
I'll just say one very last word in conclusion, and this will have to be it, which is that I would like to hope that we could increase the odds of a Reaganoff Russia or even a minimalist or even someday pro-Western Russia with some kind of big new idea on Central European security architectures. And again, there's disagreement on the panel here. Not everybody would agree with this, but I would like to see us, along with Russia, guarantee the sovereignty and security of Central Europe as part of a deal by which those countries would not join NATO, not now and not in the future. And this would be conditional on Russia verifiably upholding its end of the bargain. And I would like to see that kind of an idea considered. I think the chances are that it actually might increase the odds of one of the more benign Russias that we write about in our article. But obviously, I'm risking provoking a new conversation just as we're about to finish up. So I'll stop there. Thank you all very much for being here.